Hey, Pulse Check listeners. It's a busy week in healthcare, and our reporters, including me, have dispersed to cover the migrant crisis, HHS rollbacks of the Affordable Care Act, the latest drug pricing fights, and much more. You can read about all of those issues by visiting politico.com. But meanwhile, we're bringing you a recent conversation that I had with cancer researcher Ron DePino. It's a little different from our usual fare, but he's someone that I was looking forward to catching up with. If you're craving news analysis, check out our bonus episode this week, where we discuss the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And we're planning to be back next week with a special episode that digs into healthcare's fiercest battleground, abortion.
When you are boldly moving into a direction where you want to effect change, you need to understand that a certain fraction of individuals will be less comfortable with that change.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Ronald DePino, the former head of MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. At MD Anderson, DePino helped conceive of the idea that became the basis for President Obama's Cancer Moonshot program. And DePino joined me recently to talk about that program, what it was like running one of the nation's great hospitals, and where he thinks cancer research is going. We'll get to that conversation in a moment, but first a reminder, if you like Politico Pulse Check, help us keep it going. Rate it, review it, share it with a friend. We read all of the comments on iTunes and elsewhere, so be sure to leave us your suggestions. You can find me at ddiamond@politico.com. And now, here's Ronald DePino. Dr. Ron DePino, welcome to Politico Pulse Check.
It's great to be here.
What brings you to Washington, D.C.? What is a famous cancer researcher doing in the studio right now?
Well, we're organizing an effort to make a decisive assault on brain cancer. We brought together a diverse collection of stakeholders that can actually develop a strategic plan and implement such a plan. And the NCI has led this effort to convene this group so that we can make an impact on patients today with the great science that's emerging.
And NCI being National Cancer Institute, for listeners who might not know.
That's correct. And the new NCI director, Dr. Ned Sharpless, was present the whole time.
This effort to combat brain cancer, how do these projects get targeted? What is it about brain cancer right now that warrants a special effort?
Well, first and foremost, it's been one of the most intractable cancers. We see a lot of high-profile individuals, Beau Biden, Senator McCain, Ted Kennedy, and others that have been afflicted by this disease. It's universally fatal. For 40-plus years, there's been very little increase in the survival of patients afflicted with this disease.
What's the survival rate?
Essentially 15 to 18 months. And it extracts a very significant toll because, essentially it affects your brain and who you are. And so there's a lot of neurological side effects that occur as a result of the tumor and, in fact, the treatment as well. And so there is a lot of new science that's emerging, the genes that are abnormal in the cancer, how the immune system works and how it could be harnessed through drug manipulation to reawaken the immune system to attack the cancer. Certain viruses that are now engineered to be able to attack cancer cells but leave intact normal cells. So we wanted to try to harvest some of these new scientific insights and apply them to inventive clinical trials, testing these agents so that we can see if we can make an impact on this dreaded disease.
Looking across the specter of cancers, former HHS Secretary Tommy Thompson was on this podcast a few weeks ago talking about work that he and some associates were doing around pancreatic cancer and targeting pancreatic cancer with gene therapies. Where is the most promising advent of these technologies in cancer right now?
Well, I would say it's really across a broad front. There is a revolution ongoing in early detection of cancer, which is a very important issue for pancreas cancer because 80% of those cancers are detected too late and you can't even have surgery, widely metastatic disease, and so on. But perhaps the greatest change that's occurring in the treatment of cancer lies in the area of immuno-oncology, that is, harnessing the power of the immune system, which is normally suppressed in cancer, and using drugs to reactivate the killer cells that can recognize the cancer as foreign and attack it. And this has changed the natural history of many cancers, some of the most intractable, such as melanoma, lung cancer, bladder cancer, and many others that are now, as a result of great science, impacting patients today with advanced disease, otherwise incurable.
In my role at Politico, I'm talking to public health groups, advocates from across the spectrum, and I hear every day about the opioid issue. I hear about vaping and e-cigarettes. There are all these health concerns that might come in through my inbox and conversations I'm having. Cancer usually is not near the top. If anything, this might be the longest conversation I've already had about cancer in the past week. Do you think that there's enough mind share devoted to cancer when it comes to the policy political world? Obviously, you're a cancer researcher, so you may have some bias. How much attention do cancer issues need in this crowded space of looking at all these other public health problems?
Well, cancer itself extracts a very significant social and economic toll, $250 billion per year. So it's a significant issue for us. 1 in 2 men, 1 in 3 women will get cancer in their lifetime. So it is a major issue for our nation and the world. And it is something that has to be put towards the front in terms of doing something about it, either from policy perspectives or from treatment perspectives, because we do have a lot of actionable knowledge today that, if applied, could make a huge difference. So raising this in the consciousness of the public that cancer is not a fatal disease, that there are opportunities for us to change the history of the disease, but also our legislative champions that can fund research, such as through the National Institutes of Health, or raise awareness of the issues facing cancer patients to be able to improve their quality of life, their chances for survival, and so on. These are all things that, if the nation were to make as a national priority, would impact the cancer problem mightily for many.
When you were leading MD Anderson, you helped start the Cancer Moonshot Program at that hospital, which became a model for the Obama administration's Moonshot Program. Was the Obama Moonshot Program, which is still ongoing and in now a private sector form, was that program a sufficient response looking back?
I think one can always do more. And I think the critical thing is that it is adding much to the dialogue of cancer by highlighting it, and I think what Vice President Biden did to really highlight the tragedy that cancer inflicts on families is perhaps his greatest contribution. But what he did was to galvanize the community to begin to work together and collaborate in ways that were really necessary. And many times what I see from where I stand, either as an administrator, a scientist, or an entrepreneur, or other interactions that I have with the community, is that there is not enough convening and communication, collaboration across sectors that are needed to make an impact on the cancer problem. And so the Moonshot gave attention more than anything else to the problems and the opportunities that collaboration could seize.
But to look at it from another angle, the Moonshot program and some of the rhetoric that you and others have used about ending cancer in 10 years, does that set up false expectations that can't possibly be realized?
I think that there is a real difference. First of all, we do have a long way to go before cancer becomes routinely quelled by any strategy, be it early detection or treatment. But this time is truly different, and it's different because there's clinical proof of concept. There's no longer a supposition based on science. What we've seen over the last half a dozen years is that science has been converted into either new policies that can prevent cancer, because we understand what causes cancer in the first place, or new technological strategies that can detect cancer at more early curable stages. And in the treatment front, as we mentioned earlier, the revolution that's ongoing in immunotherapy is curing patients of disease with advanced disease that otherwise would have been lethal. And that's what's different, is that this knowledge of how the immune system works, the knowledge of the genes that are mutated in cancer, has developed into new therapeutic strategies that are curing a fraction of patients. Now, the challenge now is to not have only 25% of patients, for example, who have intractable disease be cured as a result of immunotherapy, but raising that percentages to much higher levels, and also avoiding the toxicities of these drugs. That's really where the challenge is. So what I feel now is that the knowledge and technology has reached the point where we can drive actionable information to clinical endpoints and save as many lives as possible.
It's a different climate than when President Nixon was talking about ending
cancer.
Very
different. Now, keep in mind, back then, that was before the Nobel Prize-winning discovery that genes, cancer genes, reside within our genomes. And so that gives you a perspective. The genetic paradigm that now dominates the way we think about cancer had not yet been articulated. So we've gone from a state of near complete ignorance of what makes cancer tick to identifying the genes that are aberrant in cancer through the Human Genome Project and the Human Cancer Genome Project, which has given us an atlas of genes that are altered in various cancers, to converting that knowledge into targeted therapies that are squarely directed against those rogue genes, and to now increasingly showing that patients that are enlisted into precision medicine, that is, we know what genes are altered in their specific cancer and we apply the right drug to the right patient, that those patients are seeing tremendous improvements in their survival.
I'm sure there were well-meaning researchers and scientists who in the 1970s, on their equivalent of this podcast, would be saying, we have unlocked key answers. And yet that wasn't the case. We're still talking about these issues 50 years later. What if we're wrong about using the Atlas to find these solutions? What if we are as far away from getting to answers on cancer as researchers were 20, 30, 40 years ago?
Again, I think the proof has already occurred at the level of patients where these new knowledge has been converted into new therapeutic strategies that have had a profound impact on the natural history of disease. So just a half a dozen years ago, advanced melanoma, metastatic to brain and so on, 99% of individuals were dead within a year. Today, the majority of patients are surviving 10 plus years out as a result of these new therapies that are reawakening the immune system to attack cancer. So it is truly different. At the same time, we have two major issues, and that is that we don't know all that we need to know. We know with pancreas cancer and brain cancer that those cancers are intractable. They have yet to fall to the axe of science. We must illuminate new strategies to understand why those diseases are so intractable. So much remains. And also the other issue is the issue of disparities. That is, if you can get to an institution like an MD Anderson or a Sloan Kettering or Dana-Farber or Johns Hopkins, you could have a significant improvement in your survival because of the standards of cares, the clinical trials that go on in those academic centers of excellence. But there are other parts of this country where those kinds of access to high-quality, advanced, multidisciplinary care do not exist, and those patients do not do as well. So we've got to level set, and there's also technology at this point that can be used to disseminate knowledge from these advanced centers to more community settings, empowering patients with knowledge through artificial intelligence, through mobile connectivity. These are all things that we can harness to be able to disseminate knowledge that could potentially prevent, catch cancer early, or get you to the right treatment centers.
When you say artificial intelligence can be used to disseminate technology, is that actually happening right now? Because in my work, we hear a lot about, say, IBM Watson, but then the reality of IBM Watson doesn't measure up to the hype.
Yeah, what you're seeing now is you're seeing one-off applications. It's not integrated as much into the entire workflow and fabric. But what you're now beginning to see are platforms that allow for patients with a particular molecular profile to go on certain clinical trials. So using artificial intelligence to take the sea of information from a patient and then looking at the thousands of potential clinical trials and then working through those algorithms that identify the highest priority, most appropriate clinical trials for that patient. Artificial intelligence strategies to identify patients that may develop toxicities to certain drugs, where they could be intervened with much earlier at a stage where some minor modifications in either the drug or drugs that can handle the side effects could have a dramatic impact on the quality of life for patients who will now survive their encounter with cancer. So specific strategies like that are being applied in ways that are helping manage various aspects of cancer care. But I think what you're going to see relatively quickly over the next half a dozen years is the application of AI, cloud-based technology, mobile connectivity be integrated into the fabric of consumers, where patients are going to understand how to prevent cancer, what they should be doing based on their risks, be it smokers and so on, to get screened at the appropriate stages. And also, if they do get cancer, where should they go? And are they getting the right kind of treatment strategies?
The Moonshot program is one of your legacies at MD Anderson, where you stepped down about a year ago. There was a speech as you were resigning. I've never seen a resignation speech quite like it.
I could have done a better job administratively, a better job listening, a better job communicating. Forgive me for my shortcomings. I regret them.
What went wrong at MD Anderson?
I think it was, so I'm a change agent, came into an institution with 21,000 cancer-fighting champions. It was an institution that was at the forefront for cancer treatment and care, one of the great engines for research. And I was very passionate about pushing progress very rapidly and very quickly for patients. My family was affected by this disease. I have a high sense of urgency. I'm an innovator. I am comfortable with change. Not everybody is comfortable with change. And I raised the bar. And that worked well with many, but some it didn't. And I needed to do a much better job in communication. I did not communicate my story as effectively as I should have. And that led to anxiety, confusion, and the ability for others to establish a story and a strategy that eventually made it very difficult. And I've reached a point where I was able to accomplish the things that we accomplished, launched the moonshots. We had done extraordinarily well financially. We had a very significant margin that we were able to plow back into our mission, record philanthropy, recruitment of star faculty, significant increase in funding for research as a reflection of the competitive faculty that we had.
But there was a period of hundreds of millions of dollars of loss over 11 months, 16 months near the end of your tenure.
That's right. And that's coincides with the launch of the electronic health record. And so that, in fact, you have to be clear here, that was the operating loss. That year, we still ended up with a $500 million margin overall. And then the following year, which is the year in which I resigned, it was a $700 million margin, one of the healthiest balance sheets in all of academic medicine. So that was the operating margin, which we anticipated would be below as a result of the launch of the EHR, which has been the case for virtually every academic institution that's launched an EHR.
What do you know now about running a major institution that you wish you'd known when you first started? Was it that political infighting piece?
I don't know what characterize it as political infighting. I would say that it's really that when you are boldly moving into a direction where you want to effect change, you need to understand that a certain fraction of individuals will be less comfortable with that change, that there some are hardwired to embrace change, others not. And for those that are not, to take the time to communicate and help them understand where it is you're going. And I think the results speak for themselves. The institution really enjoyed a pretty significant run, both academically, financially. The global impact was significant. We expanded our global network, for example, to reach one-third of the human population, which was quite an achievement for the men and women of MD Anderson. So I'm very proud of what our team accomplished and had a lot of very good people great faculty, fantastic nurses, great staff, very passionate, that together we accomplished a great deal for helping cancer patients.
Last question. We've talked about your path at MD Anderson and the state of politics and cancer research. What are you doing next?
Well, I'm focused on more of the global issue. 70% of cancers occur in low- and middle-income countries where there is no hope. Essentially, prevention strategies, et cetera, are really the only hope for doing something about these diseases. Many of the diseases that occur in those countries are the result of infectious diseases, human papillomavirus, hepatitis virus, and so on, for which we have vaccines. So there's tremendous opportunity to reduce the burden of cancer, pain, and suffering in some of the most indigent parts of the world. So working together with Andrew Forrest, who's a great philanthropist in Australia, he's the force behind the efforts to end modern slavery. He and I got together to develop an initiative called the Eliminate Cancer Initiative. And essentially, the strategy is to break down silos, to bring governments, industry, academic institutions, philanthropists, funders, foundations, to be able to come together in a strategic way to identify areas of opportunity, actionable knowledge, and to fund it adequately so that we can really move the needle on the disease. So things that relate to prevention are tobacco control, for example, or human papillomavirus, HPV vaccination, huge opportunities to reduce the incidence of cancer in the first place. Bringing groups together around big intractable cancers and harnessing the collective wisdom, not just of academics, but industry and government and so on, and bringing them together strategically, but also with strategic funding. It's like taking the moonshot to a global level.
I was hearing an echo of the convening power that you had behind the moonshot, yeah.
Exactly. And so that's what we're focused on now. We were in China. We had very successful meetings with highest levels of the government there, the Turnbull administration in Australia, the May administration, and Jeremy Hunt, Minister Hunt, in the UK. And today we had a great meeting with the NCI and a lot of the brain cancer, brain trust of the nation and others from around the world to try to accelerate progress in that and other cancers. It's a great day for patients and a very bad day for cancer.
Let's hope so. Dr. Ron DePino, thank you so much for joining Politico's Pulse Check.
My pleasure.
That's it for Pulse Check today. My thanks to Ronald DePino for joining the conversation and producers Micaela Rodriguez and Dave Shaw for recording the show. If you like Pulse Check, you can find it at all of your favorite podcast apps. Just search Politico Pulse Check. You can find me at ddiamond at politico.com. You can find a new episode of Politico Pulse Check in your podcast player very soon.